it's great for me to be back again. I mean, it's particularly great for Waterloo because with RIM not doing well, I'm good for the economy, so my consumption. right, so what I'm going to talk about is about depicting non-locality, which is joint work with Ross Duncan, who many people here know because he regularly visited, Alex Kissinger, who also has been here from time to time, and a Chinese person, Quanglong Wang, which may be of interest of some people here moving soon to China. So there's a paper on the archive which is called Strong Complementarity and Non-Locality in Categorical Quantum Mechanics, which is basically what I'm going to talk about now here. It's a paper which was accepted to a computer science conference, which is interesting because the paper doesn't even pretend to have anything to do with computer science. And the computer science conferences are things which are very hard to get into. It's like in top, like say, getting in PRL or something like that. It's big, it's surprising. Anyway, but we're producing a more physicsy version, which will appear in a book done by Julio and Rob, and which explains the background a bit more. So please interrupt me when you feel like interrupting me at any case. So I say, so these guys, many people know, like, I'm doing this for Julio.
Thanks.
So this is our other co-author. Okay. So this is at the wall, which is close to Beijing, and these are his students. And this is like a Chinese family.
Okay.
So this is the wife and the daughter, and the daughter really likes me a lot. Chinese people are very nice. So anyway. Yeah. Right. So the result I'm going to present here is that we establish a tight relationship between Merman-type non-locality arguments, which we profoundly generalized. So generalization is not just to say beyond qubits or beyond three-party systems, but also to more general theories. Some special notion of complementarity, which we call strong complementarity. It sort of appeared earlier in our work, but we never sort of identified this as some sort of strong form of some complementarity. And now we see that there is like a really tight collection, almost an if and only if, that you can set up a non-locality argument only if you get two strongly complementary observables available. So that's the first result. Everybody knows a sort of classification of MUBs is one of the holy grails in quantum information, but these guys, they're easily classified. So we've classified these guys, we know what they are. And I think actually that for quantum computing, it may turn out that this is really the important form of complementarity, because recently also sort of, I didn't work it out, discovered a very on-the-nose connection between this and exponential speedup. So I'm not going to talk about this today, but... So basically, like I said, we consider things in more general theories than, or more general framework than just quantum mechanics. So we got a method of discussing non-locality in a wide variety of models, in addition to quantum theory. So everything will be done fully diagrammatic. And as you will see, the computations are really, really simple. Like non-trivial computations become very simple. But what is sort of the main upshot for me of this work is that you really see where non-locality is happening. You see it happening. Oh, here it's happening. Rather than a negative statement about like violation of Bell inequality, or you really see it happening in the sort of in this kind of description which I'm going to talk about. And for the people who care about sort of diagrammatic frameworks and the upload, I think this is the most comprehensive thing so far done in this sort of realm. What is the background? This is just for people who know about these things. So. Key in all of this will be depicting classical quantum interaction purely diagrammatically, not sort of in some of the frameworks which people here have, probabilities are sort of living as labels on boxes, if you've seen talks by Julio or Lucian. So we really want to treat also classical data as part of the diagram. And important work there was initially done by Peter Selinger from Halifax. And myself, Eric Paquette, and Dusko Pavlov, we came up with a way to sort of really distinguish in diagrams classical and quantum information. In work with Ross Duncan, on which there is like a nice physically friendly paper in New Journal of Physics, we sort of came up with diagrammatic axiomatization of complementarity. And actually, in that paper already, the strong complementarity was sort of sitting there, but we didn't identified as a particular physical problem, which is part of a diagrammatic calculus. And there was also an idea of phase groups, which I explained later. And these phase groups have been used by Rob Speckens, Bill Edwards, both here now. Both here now. Bill was my PhD student, but now he's here. To really capture the essence of Rob Stoit theory in a very succinct mathematical way. And he then turned out that his phase group were really the key to understanding why quantum mechanics is non-local while his Stoit theory is local. In very much the work which I present today builds directly further on this by doing like a purely comprehensive diagrammatic treatment of these ideas and generalizing them, right? So the background framework, some of you will have seen. So the idea is that your language consists of diagrams of what you could think of as input-output processes. So you got a box which may have inputs and outputs, and then you can plug them together via input-output wires. That is, you connect the output of one box to the input of another in whatever way you want. And that's the language you play with. So there are clearly two different ways how you get to put two boxes together. You can connect an output with an input, or you just put them randomly somewhere and don't connect them. Maybe you could put a third box here then at the input, which connects them in this way. You got an idea of like multiple systems or composition of systems already, because one wire would consist of one system, then n wires would consist of n copies of the same system, basically. But you can also say zero wires, which means there's no system. So, and this is sort of the basic language in which you articulate everything. What is the axiomatic upshot of starting a So the physical interpretation, of course, is that these are processes which take something in and produce something. So this could be a measurement which takes in quantum data and produces classical data. This can be an evolution. So this, and then this is really composition of systems. Like this would be representing quantum theory, the tensor product of n systems, so like these wires side by side. But I'm not. I don't. The whole upshot of doing things like that, which and from taking this as an axiomatic approach to quantum mechanics, is that rather than sort of the Neumann perspective, where you care about a single system in isolation, and then you study measurements thereon, and this gives you a structure of the state and all that, and of properties. This is like the old program of quantum logic, you could say, which never really got very far. So what we do here is, for us, the key thing is that it's about many systems and how they interact. And basically, rather than states, we also want to think about processes as more fundamental concept. And that's very much more Schrödinger perspective, you could say. We advocated this idea that the most important thing about quantum theory is the manner in which system compose, even more important than the measurement structure. So it, in a way, it sort of shifts away from the measurement structure, hence also from the measurement problem in a certain way, to like everything is here about a tensor. Let's look now at quantum theory from the perspective that everything is about how quantum systems compose. The calculational upshot is that you get very intuitive reading of expressions, and symbolic equations become basically tautologies. I'm not going to go into that because if you can go to Pearson, that's about 5 times the same talk where I explain these things, so it's a bit pointless that I'm going to do this again. But many equations which in symbolic expression in Hilbert space would be non-trivial equations in the diagrammatic language just simply become tautologies. They don't exist anymore. And essentially, the only type of computations which you do are like topological homotopic deformations of things. You can shift things a bit around, but you keep the connections. That's how you compute. So it's very intuitive. And also a logical object. I actually just half an hour ago put a paper on the archive specifically on that. So I think that these diagrams, with a little bit more structure than the one what I present here, are some sort of new quantitative kind of logic which encompasses physics. Also, I think probability theory fits in there. A lot of the work like Rob and Matt Leifer are doing there sort of naturally fit in this kind. And I did some work on natural language, which actually uses exactly the same logical structure. So there's some quantitative kind of logic which is yet to be sort of specified and discovered, and which is very different from our traditional way of thinking about logic. The paper which I put on as the arrogant title of The Logic of Quantum Mechanics Take Two. So,
I'm sure I've asked this question before. If it's a new logic to apply to quantum, world, then shouldn't it apply directly to the microscopic world as well as to this operational world?
I would agree, yes, then, yes. It, to a great extent, it would apply to the classical things too, like probability theory.
Well, I mean the microscopic quantum world.
Do we know already what it is?
Well, I think we don't know.
I have
an opinion on what it is. But I mean, would that be your aim?
I think so, yeah.
One can look at the notion of, I think I've asked this, but you could look at quantum field theory, where
definitely
the notion of subsystem and the way you're using it doesn't seem to have a natural...
Well, I agree. Like, the way I present it here is about composition. In quantum field theory, it's more about decomposing things which are not naturally decomposed, but just we want to talk about things like, okay, here I take this region, which is very much the perspective of algebraic quantum field theory. And that is sort of comparable with this, I would say. But you have to change the story from composition to identification of things which you want to talk about. And so, yeah, I agree.
There would be also composition of different fields.
Yeah, that's the composition part, but very much like it's about like identifying also pieces of space which you then declare to be a system.
Yeah, but strongly in general, so they are not independent systems.
They're not independent, yeah.
I'm not sure, yeah, that they're
Yeah, I don't want to go into that because I haven't given that too much time yet, but it's a very good point. I agree. And indeed, like I think this sort of logic should encompass like many layers of reality, not just like the microscopic, but we've been applying this to natural language, like meaning in natural language, and it has been solving open problems. So it's clearly something to that. Anyway, so but for now going back to the quantum thing, like the little bit of extra structure which I'm going to need as sort of a basic starting template is the idea of what you could call like metrical information. And metrical information for me is nothing else than if you got a box, then you can flip it upside down. This is very much the idea of an adjoint. And once you got an adjoint, you can talk about you got your inner product, basically. You got your inner product. Because if you got a state, if you got two states, and if I'm able to flip this one upside down so that it becomes like this, then this really has to be thought of as the inner product, like a cat and a bra which you compose. You see, here you see the rotated bra, and here you see the rotated cat. So it's like a bracket. So this is the way you want to think of this. Again, I've talked a lot about this sort of stuff. It's not going to be that crucial. And a second piece of structure is that if you want to put your focus like axiomatically on the way quantum systems compose, then you should also say how they compose differently than classical physics. And this is sort of the key idea, that if you've got a pure classical system, then you can decompose it of two systems, then you can decompose it in a state for each of them. Right? That's what you can do classically. If I've got two systems, I just have to tell how this one looks and this one looks like to actually know how both look like. This is not true anymore in quantum. Now, how do you, in a constructive manner, how do you articulate this in a way you can deal with it within our paradigm? Well, you say there is, so this would be like two systems because I got two wires coming out. And I say, well, let's express that they are not sort of separated. Well, we just put a piece of wire between them. And then we're sure they are connected. And we add the one logical rule, which is still only topology matters. The thing is, like before, we only had wires which went from an input to an output. Here now we got a wire which goes from an output to an output. And so, which obviously will give us a lot more expressive power. So basically, one of the things you can do with this, and that's actually the only thing from all what I've said now that I will essentially be needing in this talk, you can define. So we already defined the idea of having an adjoint, which is you take this box and we assume you can flip it upside down. Like, that's kind of an involution, because if you do it twice, you get the original again. You can now also use this little bit of wire and the flipped upside down part to define something new, which we sort of represent, not by flipping like this, but by a 180-degree rotation. And if you apply this to linear maps and things like that, and you take this to be a Bell state, then this is exactly the transpose that you get in this manner. And if I take the bit in the middle and I flip it first and then do this, then you exactly get the conjugate. So we got now a general way to talk about transposition conjugation and adjoints, and they, of course, interact in the way you want them to interact. That's actually the only thing which I need for my story now. Okay. So what are some example models which sort of naturally live in this reality? Well, these are names of categories, because what we're dealing with are actually symmetric monoidal. Well, it's called Dagger compact categories. It's not that important. And so if you take Hilbert spaces, linear maps.
So have you introduced distinguished basis now?
There's no basis yet.
But when you say transpose,
So good point. This space is actually not strictly the same as this space. This is the dual space. And then I have a basis independent notion of a transpose. So I should actually have put an arrow or something like that here, that which indicates that this is dual to that. So this would be an upgoing arrow and that would be a downgoing arrow. And then you have a basis independent notion of transpose. Here. This one is okay. This one is okay, the conjugate. It doesn't need such a... Right. Example models. Okay. So Hilbert spaces, linear maps, tensor product, and linear algebraic adjoints. That's an example model. And then these things are Bell states. These cups are just Bell states. Within Hilbert space, you could then define, for example, stabilized quantum mechanics as a sub-theory. A completely different model would be relations, where you got relations, a composition of relations, Cartesian product of relations. So the objects there are sets, the systems are sets, which may look weird. And then relational converse has exactly the same structure as this category of Hilbert spaces. And within it, you find Rob Speckan's toy theory as a sub-theory sitting there, which is very simply defined in this context. So these are all examples of the thing which I've been describing. I'll come back to them later. Okay, here is the thing. We didn't have bases yet. Now, this is maybe the craziest step in this talk. How are we going to define what a basis is, or what an observable is, or anything of this kind? I say as spiders. Well, so what does this mean? So for us, an observable, and I'll explain why this is the case, is a family of nodes with a number of inputs, say n inputs, and a number of outputs, say n outputs, which satisfy the following equation. That if I take two of these nodes, and they are connected one way or another, then I can fuse them together. Now, why do I say that this has anything to do with like an orthonormal basis or an observable? Because this looks like something crazy and completely different. So concretely, looking for an eraser. Does anybody see one? Okay. Now there. So concretely in Hilbert space, these things would be basically things which take a string of basis vectors of this kind, say M, to a string of basis vectors of the same kind, say N, and anything else in which there is an I which is not equal to J just maps to zero. So that's concretely what these things would be in Hilbert spaces. Now there is, I can write them down in Dirac notation, for example, as so this would be N. Do people see this? So these maps, so why are these maps so special and what do they have to do with bases? Well, I use a basis to start with to encode them. So clearly, I need to have the basis specified to encode this map. The question you have is, why do they characterize the basis in general, these maps? And the reason is that I can take the simple example of this one, which basically can be interpreted as a map which copies the basis. Now, by the no-cloning theorem, we also know that if you got a map which copies a basis, then these are the only vectors which it copies. Copies nothing else. So this map really captures captures what it is for to be a basis. So why? Okay, so you can sort of already see that in this data, you can encode the basis. Now the remaining question is, if I just take anything which looks like this, any family, and just subject it to this rule, why would it correspond to a basis in any manner? And that's a highly non-trivial result. And basically what you can show is that if you think of this as some sort of weird algebraic structure for which the data is infinite, because you got all these spiders from M to N, and you got an amazing amount of rules, you can show that this is equivalent to something which is called some sort of Frobenius algebra, which is something which occurs, which came out of representation theory and which mathematicians in quantum algebra use a lot. We need special kind of Frobenius algebra, actually literally Dagger special commutative Frobenius algebra, it's not important. But you can show that these things are actually equivalent to such an algebra. And in the second order, you can show that these particular algebras, if you work with Hilbert spaces, are on the nose equivalent to orthonormal basis. So the actions of that algebra forces these things to be of this form, nothing else. So you really get a characterization, this very, very crazy characterization of what is an orthonormal basis by writing down such a family of. So it's like basically it's like a node in a graph. It's a node in a graph. It can have many things coming in, many things coming out, and there is this special equational compositional rule about it. So that's for us an observable. So it's a very simple diagrammatic notion. So going back again to the more axiomatic perspective, so the language which you use here is nothing but the language of tensor product. So it's writing down what the orthonormal basis is without any reference to sums or things like that. It's just like writing down what an orthonormal basis is by only appealing to the tensor product symbol and composition of linear maps, but not to like underlying some structure or anything like that. Okay, we can do more. Okay, so that's what I already said. Like the spider families for Hilbert spaces are exactly orthonormal bases. We can do more. Namely, what we can do is we can stick, this is some kind of state, and we can stick this in here. And then it easily follows that by the spider rules, that there is some way that you could combine these points. Now, the clever thing to do is to only restrict these particular states which you stick in to those who satisfy the following equation. So I'm writing down. This is like, again, a very special kind of spider. It has two inputs and one output. It's like a multiplication or something like that. Like it actually forms a monoid for it's like a group without inverses. So I take some point alpha here. And now I'm going to only take those alphas which are such that if I take the conjugate, like concretely in Hilbert space, you can really think of the conjugate, but I defined the conjugate abstractly before. So I can do this in a wide class of theories. Gives this. And this is literally saying, this would be the unit of this multiplication. So this is literally saying, I take those alphas for which the conjugate is the inverse. And then by construction, I get a group. Now, what is this group concretely? If you do this for a basis, say for a qubit on the Bloch sphere, then in this manner, you will actually find the equator of phases. This will define for you the equator of phases. So what you basically get is phased spiders, and this would be addition of the phases, or multiplication of the phases. So that's why we call these phase groups. And they will play a very important role. Like, for example, one of the things Rob, Bill, and I figured out is that while for stabilizer quantum mechanics, which is a restriction of this equator to sort of four states. You just take the y and the x eigenstates. So you got 4 points. And this structure is Z4. It's like the cyclic group Z4, of course, because you add up. I mean, in Rob Stoy theory, this turns out to be the Z2 times Z2 group. And that's really the origin of the locality of his theory, it turns out. So you can learn, it's an important concept which you can learn things about, and it will play a key role in this talk. So you have now this, we call these decorated spiders, and they're decorated with these faces, and for general abstract reasons, these faces form a group, an abelian group. Right, okay, we're almost there. So I'm actually going very quickly to something which took a really long time to all get together and set up, like about 8 years. So what I want to do now is have a way to distinguish classical from quantum. So I'm gonna, so don't look too much at the picture yet. I'm gonna sort of guide you towards this picture. So suppose you got a density. Think of this. This is a density operator rho. This is a density operator rho. What can we do? We can actually use Choi-Jamolkovsky to turn it into a bipartite state, right? We can always do this. Now, this is a positive operator. This is a positive operator. And a positive operator can always be written as something composed with its adjoint, right? That's a positive operator. So we can split this into two. Let's say this and this have adjoint. And now we can use our notion of transposition to actually slide this back, because that's how we define transposition, like it's 180 degree rotation. So I'm going to you know, if this is this is an equation you probably know. If you have a linear map, like F on Choi state, then this is the same as putting the transpose of that map, which we denote like this, at the other side. So that's basically just what I'm using, that idea, which actually follows just from the graphical notation. So the next thing which I can do here is I can take this guy away. And I put it here. So this is now the conjugate, because it's sort of a horizontal reflection. And I can use again Choi-Jamolkovsky. Actually, I could have used this representation, but I could use again Choi-Jamolkovsky to turn these things in bipartite states. And then I get this. And so here I've got some state psi, phi. Here I've got the conjugate. And that's what you see on this picture. So this is sort of a very funny representation of a density matrix. That's what it is. It's a funny representation of a density.
You mean the complete
density matrix. Yeah, start with a density matrix.
You drew the role as a box.
Yeah, what I wrote was actually the density operator, like the matrix, which has an input and an output.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I really did it. I treated it as in linear algebra. I know where you're coming from. You're being too smart. No, I just treat this as a density operator, and then as I showed how such a representation comes out. Okay, so now we want to measure the density operator. We want to measure the density operator. And so if I would write this down concretely, then this would be the sum of some rho ii, say, in ii. Well, with the comment Raphael just made, one of these actually should be conjugate. It's like in the lives actually in the dual space, but that's less important. So one of these should live in the dual space, because otherwise it doesn't work. And then you got sums over I not equal to j of rho ij and some ijs here. Right? Now, suppose I put this here. You remember, this was one of my spiders which I introduced. So what is this map? Like I said, it looks like this. So it takes two things in and produces one. So it produces one and takes two in. If I apply this to this, what do I get? So it clearly is not going to take in these, because it forces the two i's to be the same. So it just got, so, and it just substitutes this by one, so you get a sum of I of rho I. That's what you get. So this is, rho I. So this is like the vector of probabilities on your diagonal. So these are the probabilities for the measurements, for the possible outcomes for doing a measurement in that in that particular basis which you encode. That's what it is, right? So I can treat this. This is for me like a classical wire, and what flows in it is like probabilistic data, which is a distribution of the probabilities over the different possible outcomes. So this is the quantum part, and this is the classical data which comes out of it. And the paradigm you see, which is sort of graphical paradigm which comes out of it, is a quantum system is represented by two wires, and a classical system is represented by one wire. And it's justified by the computation which I just did. So it's a way to represent taking some quantum system and measuring it. Now, this doesn't have to be a state. This can also be a completely positive map which acts something and so on. If I would have a completely positive map, I would represent it, say, like this. I would represent it like this. So now you also got an input, an output, and some connection. And this looks very much like the Krauss representation, you know? So if you take Krauss representation, then you got here one set of operators, there the adjoints, and this actually corresponds to this side. And the summation over I is actually this wire. That's like the summation over I.
These representations are not unique in general.
Huh?
No.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. I can have many different which boil out to be the same. Yeah. Well, you can play around and make them. There are ways to make them unique if you want to, but definitely not at the level I'm doing it here. Yeah. You could sort of always say this is the minimal one, or this is canonical in some way that it actually is the tensor of these spaces. Okay, so this is classical quantum interaction, and the paradigm, like I say, you get out of it is like if you see one wire, it will be classical. If you see two wires in a sort of symmetric representation, then it's quantum. Okay. Right. Okay. So yeah, I'm just throwing all these concepts at you because they're all going to come together at some point.
On a single vector space. And so basically it's represented by a vector where only the weights matter. The weights are the probabilities.
So this is a fully symmetric picture always. So you got here something and there it's conjugate. And this is the case here too. And that actually imposes positivity of the values of your probabilities.
Okay.
Here is the vector. I wrote it.
Right.
That's the vector. And it has positive coefficients. So you really think of it as a probability distribution which flows through your wires.
I just wanted to make sure it's an unconventional way of representing classical things within quantum formalism. We don't usually write down vectors whose
But usually people try to do the other way around. They try to represent quantum as much as possible by using classical language. So I think this is the more natural thing to do. Because this is a logic which is not that much attached to the material physical layer, and so in that sense the thing which is here could of course be implemented quantum mechanically in a decoherent manner, and that's this ambiguity whether you can actually represent classical probability in a density matrix which is diagonal. Is kind of a feature of this that it it's more like model. This can be classical. It doesn't have to be. This has to be quantum. If you can't get well. Right. So now strong complementarity. Again, a totally weird picture which doesn't remind you in any way of what you've seen about complementarity. But again, if somebody would be sitting here in the room who knows a lot about quantum algebra and quantum groups, or Hopf algebra and these sort of things, he would immediately recognize this. He would say, yeah, that's called a bi-algebra. That's called a bi-algebra. So let me just say what a bi-algebra is. Can you see the difference in colors here? Not very good, I guess.
No.
Not at all. This is all the same color. That's annoying. Maybe I should start. So
one is a little darker.
One is a little darker, yeah. So basically what you got is you got here one thing coming in, two coming out, and this is the same one, and this is the same one. Here you got one, two coming in, one coming out. This is the same one, and this is the same one. And this is sort of an expression that these two things commute through each other. And if you, and it's sort of the simplest way you can do it. So it's kind of a commutation of something which is like a multiplication, two in and one down, and something which is like an upside down multiplication, one in and two down. Now, and this is kind of, suppose this would then be the unit with respect to, this would be the unit with respect to this multiplication, am I right? Yeah, okay, so, and this is sort of copied through, and that's, so, and this is like a very natural notion in algebra, it's called the bi-algebra. But we kind of reverse engineer it. Rose and I, we were looking at a problem of transforming measurement-based circuits into standard circuits, and in some sort of elegant way using this language. And we really needed this equation to do anything. And so then we designed some calculus to reason about qubits, which we called ZX calculus, and these were equations which were in it. Now, the amazing thing is like that now we kind of realize that this is some sort of strong form of complementarity, which seems to be needed for fundamental things like non-locality. Now, let me show you why we even think that this has anything to do with complementarity. It's going to be, again, take a little bit of time. So I'm writing this equation here. So this is this equation. So now you can see it. So you got the colored dots and the open dots. So the next thing we do is we stick in here a colored dot, there an open dot, a colored dot. And now you should look at the topology of this thing. So I start here with this white dot. It goes to a color dot. I write the color dot here, and I represent this wire by this. Now, what do I've got here? Here I've got a white dot and another white dot, so I can fuse them in a big white dot. This one I fuse in an open dot. And so you see I've got something going down from here to there, but it sort of makes a little squeeze. And I'm going to represent this squeeze just by a little tick here. So essentially what I get there is something like this. Now using these equations, you see this guy is copied. This guy is copied. And so basically what we get is this and this. Now, I probably didn't convince you that this has anything to do with complementarity, but Ross Duncan and I, we proved that this equation on the nose means unbiasedness. This is unbiasedness. Like if you know that each of these nodes represents a basis, and if two bases satisfy this equation, then they're unbiased. And that's an if and only if. That's an if and only if. And you can actually even derive this. You can actually, the idea of a basis vector you can define abstractly, like just something which is copied by some of these algebras. And there is similarly, you can also define the idea of unbiasedness more abstractly, and then you still get this equation. So it's something which is very conceptual, a very conceptual way of thinking of unbiasedness. Now, if I've got this instead, then I can derive this. So I'm dealing with something stronger than unbiasedness or complementarity. At the moment, I don't give you a physical interpretation of this, what this strength means, but actually that's going to be a result of the non-locality analysis. There you get an interpretation of this, which directly relates it to non-locality. Okay, so I think we're...
I got a question about this. So is it correct, the color thing is one basis and the
other color, yeah,
thing is
yeah.
A different basis.
And this is a way, this is an equation, and this is a relationship between the two bases. This relationship means that they are mutually unbiased. Mutually unbiased. This means something stronger. Because from this I derived the mutual unbiasedness. So that's why we call this strong. So complementarity we use like as a, almost as a synonym with unbiasedness. So yeah, I should have.
So when you talk about complementarity, you're thinking of two observables or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you want to call them strongly complementary.
If they satisfy
if
this.
Corresponding bases are mutually unbiased, and moreover, they satisify this.
So the mutual, but this implies the mutual unbiasedness
right,
order.
But this is somehow stronger.
This is stronger. This is strictly stronger. I'm going to say this at the end, and I'm going to say how many there are. Because I in dimension 2 and 3, all mutual unbiased bases satisfy this. But once you go to 4, they don't grow anymore. I can say there's actually, you cannot, they only come in pairs. They only come in pairs. Well, mutually unbiased bases, there's, well, something like the dimension plus 1 for those cases which are known. These guys always come in pairs.
Spiders or something like that. So are there more relations when you
from this one you can derive a whole bunch. But this is sort of the generating one. We're actually gonna use one with more legs, if I've got time.
So, when you say they come only in pairs, do you mean only one pair for every dimension? Or do you mean
No, you can of course move them around. But they're actually classified by groups, by abelian groups. Oh, okay. So it's nice that it becomes a lot of group theory. It's good that they invite me for this group theory thing, because there's a lot of group theory coming in here. Anyway, so what we want to define, now we want to sort of move to the type of scenario where you do a Merman-style argument. So what do you do in a Merman-style argument? You write down a GHZ state. That's the classical Merman argument. You consider the GHZ state, and then you do measurements either in X or Y. So you do measurements in some basis. So you can identify this GHZ state with the computational basis, with the Z basis, because it's written down in the Z basis. And actually, it characterizes the Z basis. And then now you want to set up, say, what is a measurement in a basis complementary to it. And this is how we do it. So this is actually a dark dot. So this would be a Z measurement. One pair of strongly complementary observables, I should have said that. One pair of these, an example, the simplest example, is that this would correspond to the Z basis and this to the X basis, for example. And now I'm going to start building measurements with these guys. So this would be a measurement in the X basis. And this is a phase in the Z basis. Phases in the C basis are rotations on the equator. So if this is an X measurement, they allow me to change an X measurement in a Y measurement, for example, by rotating it around with the phases. So this is, for the qubit, all the measurements along the equator you can do by sticking the appropriate phase here. So this is the measurement along the equator for a qubit, but it generalizes to arbitrary dimension because this notion of phase group generalizes. And this, for example, also are the measurements on the equator in Rob's toy theory. That's what they are in that theory. Not going to talk about it. It's important, but think of it as conjugate space. Conjugate space, yeah. Conjugate space, because otherwise you can't make sense of conjugation. Conjugate space. Okay, now we can finally start computing things. So here I've got a GHZ state, so a dot with stuff coming out. So this would be this particular state, because that's how I defined my spiders, initially giving a basis. So this is my GHZ state. By my convention, I represent it twice. That was my convention. And then I measure on the first qubit, the second qubit. I can take many more if I want to. And on the last qubit, I put 3. But this can be a GHZ state of m parties. Doesn't really matter. And this doesn't have to be a qubit. So this here, what I've got here is performing measurements on a GHZ state in some basis which is orthogonal to the basis in which you express the GHZ state. So that's the usual setting. Well, it's much more general than the Merming setting, but that's the usual idea. And this is how we compute what comes out. This is how we compute the correlations. It's very simple. The first thing we do is we see we got all these phases here, and we know we can put them all together. You remember this phased spider? So you basically take all these 3 ones here and you pull them out down. You take these 3 ones, you pull them out down. What you see now, I don't know whether you recognize it, you got here 2 Y dots, there are 2 red dots, and then a cross in the middle and 2 things, which is exactly this type of shape. So it sort of naturally pops up there. The only difference is that The only difference is that you seem to have more things coming out. And like Raphael said, this equation actually is something which follows from the other one, that this reduces to this two. So it's like a one-step thing, and that's it. End of computation. These are the classical correlations we get out of this computation. Yeah?
Sorry, the chief just states on three units, but you have some n.
Yeah, no, it can be n. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Yeah, I shouldn't have said three here. This should have been n. This is a typo.
Okay.
This should have been n. Doesn't matter.
So
it doesn't matter. Yeah, it can be n dimensions, n parties. It doesn't matter. And these angles can be anything. They don't have to be y and z, x and z, x and y. I mean, they can be anything. But it's a remarkable simple computation here via this piece of algebra. Thank you. Got your correlations here. And for example, we know what you, for example, know is if this, for example, ends up being as a whole a y dot, then I know that we get perfect correlations, like even correlations, like what you get in the Mermin argument if you do x x x. If on the other hand, this would add up to say pi, then this actually turns out to be like the end correlations which you get for YYX. So it's already all built in. But we're gonna give a nicer analysis of that now. So this is sort of basic computation. So one thing which you should notice is these are individual measurements which different people do. The different agents do these measurements. They can choose these at any time as close as possible to the actual measurement. And then you see this first step of this computation already, these things which are locally defined by its agents suddenly only matter globally. They just all add up. So there is very little local going on here. The diagrams immediately tell it doesn't really matter whether this one does A3 and this A2 or this one A3 and this one A2. It's all the same. The only thing which matters is their sum. The rest doesn't matter. So that's when I say you visualize no locality in this equation, because you see they have no ability to sort of do something specific locally, because it's just going to add up globally. There is this funny thing going on, which is remarkable. You don't have to look very hard to see the non-locality. Like, you see it there. And it's almost like, yeah, okay, you expect non-locality, and the fact that in certain theories you end up not getting non-locality seems more like a degeneracy. That something degenerates is good, yeah?
Okay, so for two qubits, I think the usual GZ construction doesn't work. It's not non-local, right?
No, you don't have enough structure there.
So does that come out in your
yeah. You can't set up, I have to do, this doesn't give me a contradiction yet. This gives you sort of an intuition of how non-local things are. Now I still have to exploit this and set up a contradiction. This could all just be, you know, what I want to show is essentially that, let me do the argument, you'll see how it works. I haven't set a formal contradiction up yet. I just gave you a weird sort of observation that all these local choices only contribute globally. Which also already gives you a view. So there's actually nothing really local there in the picture. There's nothing local. Everything is global from the start. And now we want to use this to set up a contradiction. Of course, these theories can be trivial. Could be that any diagram you write down is the same and that you'll never get a contradiction of any kind. So you need to do some work to set up a contradiction. Right. The only thing I wanted to say here, well, I'm going to skip this. So this is the situation for measuring three x's. So x would, because that observable was an x measurement, I don't have to do a rotation. So I do just zero rotation. We do the computation we did before. So this is actually, so I should show this on the qubit. So this is the plus point here. This is the plus point, the zero rotation point, which is actually also a classical point, a basis vector for the other observable. So I'm changing the color to a triangle to indicate this is a basis vector for this observable. So it gets copied. And this is what I get. And then similarly, if I do an x measurement and two y measurements, so these 2 minus pi over 2s, they end up to, they add up to minus pi. These pi over 2s add up to pi. They are the other basis vector of this observable, so we get this. Here already you see what goes wrong with Rob Stoy theory for non-locality. Because here the computation would be different. Anybody except Rob picks that up? You don't really have a pi there. Pi is zero. If you do pi, yeah, if you do pi over 2 times pi over 2, you get zero because it's z2 times z2. It's a different group. So this would be zero here. And these things are the same, and my contradiction is going to follow from the fact that these things are different. Right. So now we want to, so we haven't made a locality assumption yet. Of course, to get a contradiction of Mermin kind, we need a locality assumption. So how am I going to do this? I'm not going to specify this fully. That's not what I need. So basically, we're going to consider four scenarios, x, 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 y, 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 x, y, 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 x. And locality says that in principle, the values, so consider the bunch of hidden states here. So you get a bunch of hidden states sitting in here. And for an hidden state, if one specific hidden state, you would assume that it assigns the same values to this x dependent of the other one is like x, x, or y, y. So we're just going to copy them out. We're going to copy them out. And what we're going to derive is a sharp contradiction between whatever you can get out of here for any hidden state and what quantum mechanics predicts. And so everybody sees this idea of we use just copying to say that in these different scenarios, these x are the same. So we just use some spaghetti monster like here. So this would be x for the first system, y for the first system, x for the second system, y for the second system, x for the third system, y for the third system, and we just copy them out to get the four Mermin scenarios. Now, another theorem one has, specifically for such a pair of strongly complementary observables, is that the classical points, which are the basis vectors of, say, the gray observable, form a subgroup of this phase group I mentioned before of the white observable. So you got this group of these equators sitting here, which are these phases. And then, yes, indeed, this is plus and this is minus. They form a subgroup. They form a subgroup, Z2. And this is true for general reasons if you got this strong complementarity. You always get this subgroup. And there's a nice interpretation of them because you got your subgroup here. And you can think of them as measurement outcomes for a measurement, like this for the X measurement. And the other ones are actually changes of measurements. They are your cosets. Sort of, if you, for your quotient group. So now the more important thing which I want to get out of this is that actually the subgroup corresponds to some notion of parity. Like in this case, this is Z2. Z2 means parity. Parity is nothing else than Z2, right? Parity is Z2. So that's what does parity. So you get this subgroup here, and this sort of in the Mermin argument plays the role of parity. So I can just use my white spiders to compute the parity of classical data. Because that's what this group is. It computes parity for you. Again, it's sort of, in general, you got a more generalized notion of parity. It would not be valued in Z2, but in some other group. For the specific case of Mermin, it would be valued in Z2. Okay, so what we did was we computed these different scenarios. And when you got x, 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 we got this form. When you got x, y, y, you got this form. And now we use our parity. Well, we use actually just a mapping here to see what this gives us. So this is quantum mechanics. This is what quantum mechanics tells us. And if you compute this thing, this particular shape, which I choose for certain reasons, you end up with this. So you get a 0 and a 1. This is what quantum mechanics tells us. So you will always get opposite answers here. This is like what people would refer to even combinations, and these are the odd combinations. Yeah?
Just on your last slide, you're talking about the parity. So for a 2 in and 1 out, I can see how this uncopying operation would take 0, 0, and 1, 1, the one thing, is it the same?
Yeah.
0, 1, 1, 0, something else. So it's measuring parity. But for 3 inputs, it seems what it will tell me is whether they're all the same or not. And that doesn't, that's not
the... No, the thing is, you're measuring parity in the other observable. You're not counting the numbers of zeros and one. You're actually, what comes in, you're measuring the parity of plus and minuses. Like if you write down the GHZ state, the GHZ state is actually this plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. It's the same. And that's what, and that's the thing what you're measuring parity of. Because my outcomes came out of the black observable, the dark observable. And then this really measures parity. You can do an analysis of that based on the subgroup argument. So I should have said that. But that's the thing, because you're right. Otherwise, this clearly is not parity, yeah. So, but anyway, so now we apply the same thing to the thing which imposes our locality assumption. Basically, from this to this, you're not really seeing what's happening, but the only thing which is happening is the spider rules. And here you see a red dot and there a white dot with two wires in between. And by complementarity, like I mentioned before, those go away. Now here we can, we again, it's maybe hard to see, have this strong complementarity law. And then we compute this, and you see you get something perfectly symmetric. So the Mermin contradiction now becomes, here you got something which is forced to be symmetric, which are all your hidden states, and quantum mechanics predicts that these things are orthogonal, different. So they can't be symmetric. So that's your contradiction. And this scheme, right, you can apply to much more general situations, of course. And basically, yeah, I'm running out of time. So I've got a slide on which I sort of concretely made a construction of a bunch of generalized Mermin arguments. And the case, for example, of Rob Stoy theory boils down to the fact that the previous argument always boils down if your phase group factors, like if your phase group is actually a direct product of this subgroup which I defined and the quotient groups. And that's when non-locality breaks down. So you can now do more general analysis of non-locality. But the last thing I wanted to say is, so in this computation, we relied a lot on this strong complementarity. And now I want to do the converse. I want to show that this is a necessary condition to even set up a Mermin type non-locality argument. And that's the main point, that they are tightly related. So one of the key things to set up a Mermin argument is that after performing two of the three measurements, the remaining system is in an eigenstate of the corresponding measurement. Because the whole idea of a Mermin argument is that measurements give certain outcomes, so that you got like fixed outcomes. So you need this property to be true. We're going to express this graphically. So here you got, we do measurement on the first system, on the second system. And then the third system should be decoherent. And that it's decoherent, you can express by sticking on something. This is actually the same as this is the map which kills all your off-diagonal elements, because you saw that going from 2 to 1 kills all the off-diagonal elements. And then if you stick it again in 2, then the only thing you have F are your diagonal elements. So this is like diagonalization. Then you can, from this equation, what we are going to do is we're going to stick in a white point here so that this vanishes. We stick in a white point here so that this vanishes. We get this. Now, so this is equal to this. And then by symmetry, it's also equal to this. So you get this equation here. Now, if you look at this thing, we sort of... The first thing we do is like we again use the spider law. We take this and we pull this out here. So we take this, we pull this out here, but we keep these guys down here. Then we use our previous equation, which involved sticking in one of those. This was true by our previous equation. And then you see, if you then now pull all of that stuff down and then stick these guys in these white dots, you get this. Now, these are unitary maps, so I can apply the adjoints to it. And what I obtain is tennis. And a dark blue here. So that's what I obtain. And then I can prove to you that this is equivalent to this law of this strong complementarity. I'm not going to do that, but this is actually equivalent to this other equation, where instead of this, you add this. So putting this here or that turns out to be the same thing. And so what we showed is there is clearly this tight connection between this notion of strong complementarity and setting up a non-locality argument. So for the future, recently, I'm still working the details out, but we've set up a similar analogy between strong complementarity and exponential speedup in quantum algorithms. And that would then, putting the two together, relate non-locality directly to exponential speedup. So for the exponential speedup, the framework I'm referring to is the class of hidden subgroup algorithms. So here you got a classification result, which maybe I don't. So this is a classification result for the strongly complementary observables. That every pair of strongly complementary observables for Hilbert spaces is of a certain form where some finite abelian group is into play. And this finite abelian group is exactly this subgroup which we got at some point of classical outcomes of the phase group. So that's the subgroup. And this subgroup classifies these observable, these pairs of strongly complementary observables. And this exactly corresponds then with the sort of hidden subgroup arguments you can set up. So there's still some work to be done. Like the other theorem which I said is that in Hilbert space of dimension bigger or equal than 2, these sort of things can only compare wise. You can't have 3 of them which are mutually strongly complementary. So they always come in pairs. So they come with a canonical mapping. And this canonical mapping is actually a generalized Fourier, the generalized Fourier matrix you find in hidden subgroup algorithms. So but I think key to this is this sort of strong notion of complementarity.
Can you say a little more about the connection you want to establish between speed up and non-locality? Because I mean, that's a dubious connection, given that maybe there's a lot of questions about that.
I'm sure. That's why I didn't want to talk about it. Because
you know, the states that are highly entangled, there exists some, the Clifford group generates states that are highly entangled,
but there's definitely, I haven't thought much about that. The only thing I can say is, like, if you set up that the general hidden subgroup algorithm goes via what is a certain generalized Fourier matrix, and these generalized Fourier matrix, they're on the nose. In correspondence with strongly complementary observables in Hilbert spaces. And so there is this direct connection with the sort of story I just told of Mermin-type arguments. If you got such a pair, you can set up a Mermin argument. And to set up a Mermin argument, you need such a pair. And so at the moment, it's sort of an indirect connection. So it would be much better to understand it directly, but I haven't worked it out yet. I don't think... I don't think I've got anything more to say here, except for the summary. Yeah, that's it.
So we have time for 2 questions.
I'm trying to understand the content of strong complementarity. So let me ask for a clarification. You said strong complementarity is necessary for driving non locality groups. And for a qubit, every pair of mutually unbiased spaces is a
Q3 too.
For the toy theory, are the mutually unbiased pairs also strongly complementary, or do they fail to be strongly complementary?
They are.
They are strongly complementary.
Yeah.
So it's not accurate to say that the difference between the locality of one and the non-locality.
Oh no! You need more. You need specific structure of your phase group. And like the phase group shouldn't factor, for example.
So the phase group is an independent feature.
It should be. The thing is, it should be a non. The phase group shouldn't be of the form subgroup times cosepts, because then it breaks down. And if that's not the case, then you get a non-locality argument. So your phase group is wrong in your toy theory. It's something which factors, and it shouldn't factor. And the non-factorization is what you exploit to set up a non-locality contradiction. So, if you, so for example, in the case that of Q trits, Z3 times Z3, that goes wrong, which is the same for the toy theory as for Q-trit stabilizer theory.
So,
but the thing is, like, for Q-trits, that's not a problem because we don't have to stick to stabilizer theory. We can because the whole argument doesn't care about which angles you chose. You saw only the sums matter.
Okay, so what I was thinking is wrong. I was thinking a biasness has to do just with the overlaps of all the elements of one basis with all the elements of another. But there's more information in those two bases. There's things like, you know, when I coherently superpose the elements of this basis to get elements of this one, you know, how exactly does that map out? And that sort of thing is different in the toy theory compared to quantum mechanics. But strong complementarity is not about those properties.
I don't think so, no.
So can you say what extra information is there? Besides?
I don't know. What I know is what I showed here. What it guarantees, so I think this is the closest you can come to an operational interpretation. Well, for me, the simplest. If I set up a G at Z state in one observer, so forget about these things. Forget about these things. I set up a G at Z state in one observable. I do measurements in the other. And then the third system is automatically in an eigenstate. That's not true in general for complementary observables. This is true for these guys. And maybe you can... I don't know. It's something which is hard to physically capture, but it seems to be closely related to many things like this speed up and locality. So it's a funny beast. It definitely everything you do in quantum computing with qubits, you're always playing around with these because they're all complementary observables are like this. So without knowing, you've always been playing with this, and if you start like analyzing many like the sort of computation that you compute 3 C NOT gates and you alternate it and you get the swap relies on this equation.
So maybe it's fair to say that whereas unbiasedness can be defined intrinsic to the vector space, right? I only need to look at the overlaps. Strong complementarity, you have to have a notion of entanglement on composite systems to evaluate whether a given pair of bases are strongly complementary or not. It has more to do with steering, and it's not just a
property. Yeah, so an equivalent characterization is, I can set up a multiplication if I have a basis, like some sort of multiplication. This would be this, right? I can stick in two things. So if I take strong complementarity is equivalent to, these are classical points of the dark observable, and I multiply them by means of the white observable, then I get again a classical point of the dark observable. So it means like this multiplication defines a monoid on the classical points of the other. So that's sort of the more mathematical Hilbert space formulation of the thing, but it's not clear what it means conceptually. But it implies unbiasedness. This is stronger than unbiasedness.
But can you just say what, even just purely mathematically, what was the condition? So
that's what I just. This is a mathematical condition, huh?
That's a condition for which is for the strong.
That's equivalent. That's equivalent.
Which is, and what is the condition? Can you express it in the other more old-fashioned language? You have a base. You have.
So you got your two.
Bases.
You got two bases from one
each
basis. From one basis, from one of the two, it doesn't matter from which, you build the multiplication. And it's closed. So you got a monoid. So it's closed on this classical point. So if you multiply two with this multiplication, you get another one. So it defines a monoid on the classical points of the other observable. The multiplication of one defines a monoid on the basis vector of the other.
You can multiply any two basis vectors.
By means of the multiplication of the other, and you get again a basis vector.
Yeah. Basis vector.
Yes.
For this, that's what it means.
Yes, that's what it means.
Multiplication means decomposing this basis vector
Yeah. And then so comparing the same. Yeah. Yes. Then you sort of take the diagonals. Yeah. That's it.
That's a fairly simple.
Yeah. But that's a pure.
What it means,
yeah, I have no clue. This is the closest we get to a physical one, actually, here. But it looks. So this is all equivalent. It doesn't look equivalent, but it's all equivalent.
It's not even obvious, at least to me, that implies mutual unbiasedness.
Well, it does.
Maybe it does.
It does. Yeah.
Doesn't sound that.
Yeah.
So here's the slogan for you. I think I get it a bit better now. That mutual unbiasedness depends only on the absolute values of the inner products of one basis with another.
Right. Oh, there's more going on.
Depends on the phases.
Yes,
well.
definitely.
You could have imagined that
definitely.
Yes. I'm copying in the 0-1 basis. I could have had something that wasn't plus coming out in the phase.
So the proof of what you just asked, whether one implies the other, is I talked about this phase group, which arises like from the multiplication of one observable on its unbiased points. Now, since your observables are mutually unbiased, the classical points of the other observable are unbiased. So definitely, you would always get an unbiased point, but not one of these subgroup of classical points. So that's sort of the direct comparison why one does imply another in terms of this definition. So it's whether it's inclusive in the whole phase group or just this subgroup.
I mean, there are other examples of non-locality that are in some logical way simpler than the GAZ example. So that you can make, or we could even start with quantum Speicher, which is in some sense in itself an example of something, and can be converted into an example of non-locality.
Yeah, I can't say anything about that with this. No, I can't say anything about that with this.
Or take Lucian's example.
Oh, but that may be doable. I never did it, but that may be doable, I think. That's more of a qualitative nature. So we do have I didn't talk about it, but we do have a derivation of sort of the CHSH in this sort of language too, but it's much more messier to present because we haven't sort of made it elegant yet, the computation. But you get it out in this purely, and again, you need to rely on this strong notion of complementarity to get it. Otherwise, your computation doesn't sort of get through. You just get stuck. So I'm sure that this also comes in Bell inequality, Bell type scenarios.
So you've given a complete classification of strong complementary observables. Does that shed any light on the problem of constructing complete sets of models?
This is easy and that one is difficult. I think that's basically it. This is really easy and that one is really difficult, it seems. So I don't think you can learn anything from it. Well, maybe, I don't know. Well, maybe, I don't know. Not in any obvious manner. I think these are sort of, I would say these are nice pairs. These are nice pairs, but they are so nice that actually they don't want anybody else around. This sort of a monogamy, it's a monogamic notion of complementarity. Maybe we should have called it like that. Because you can only be strongly, it's strongly married to one at most. That is actually a good name, monogamous complementarity. Damn, should have thought about that before.
Is it obvious that the relationship is symmetric, so the way you described it.
This is symmetric because this is equivalent to this equation, and this equation is clearly symmetric.
In that sense, it looks obvious, but in the way you said, basis one defines the multiplication.
Yeah. So,
and then the elements of basis two are closed set under that multiplication. If we reverse the definition.
The way to prove this the easiest is you take these two bases, you take the unitary transformation which transforms one in another. So it actually changes the colors, and then you push it through this equation, and it sort of flips the colors.
have a comment that when you're looking at the connection with computational speedup, the circuit model makes it difficult because, you know, we know that the stabilized performance has a GHC proof functionality,
right,
and yet it's efficiently simulated flow classically. But if you go to the measurement-based model, then there's this nice result by Dan Brown that if your processor has only parity linear transformations, so no AND gates, and your measurement-based model has GHZ states, then you can simulate an AND gate. And so you actually can get universal classical computations,
right,
using GHZ states, but a smaller class of computations without them.
Right.
That seems like a more natural place to try to apply these techniques,
mm,
because we already know that the GHZ state is a resource for that kind of promotion.
Right. Yeah, these things are tightly connected because actually, in part, this stuff emerged partly from looking specifically at that stuff, that Dan Brown stuff. Yeah. But like I say, I can't comment on the speed. I just like, I know that the Fourier matrices in the hidden subgroup algorithms are exactly these guys, kind of guys. That's what I know. And then I had to start organizing conferences. As some people here know, which I've been doing now almost for 3 weeks. So.
If there are no more questions, let's thank you for
Thanks, Jesse.